Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there and support the show and get plenty of bonus content.
Yeah, do it. Aaron, did you watch, although it would be very weird if you did you watch the Oscars?
No.
All right. Well, I'm sure you heard about the controversy, right? Where a Jewish director of a very good movie about the about Hess living next to Auschwitz said he refuted his Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked.
Wait, all I heard there, Katie, did you say he refuted his Jewishness? And I'm
exactly. And that's,
I'm deeply offended.
I'm
deeply offended, and I demand he apologize. That's all I heard in that last sentence that you said.
Right.
That's how dare he refute his Jewishness on a live broadcast too? This is offensive. I hope somebody held him to account for this.
Oh yeah, lots of people did. Lots of people did. Yeah.
Good.
Don't worry about that. Yeah. But it was truly amazing. A Jewish guy made this film, wants people to connect the genocide that happened during the Holocaust to the genocide happening now. And for that, he was called a traitor, self-loathing Jew, and really people just misrepresented what he said. It was such a bald-faced lie.
Yeah, I mean, they did what I just satirically did, which is that they omitted the part where he says, like, you know, I refute my Jewishness being used for occupation. That's pretty much what he said. And they just forgot, they took out the occupation part, and they just said he was like, it was as if he was like getting up there to like renounce his Judaism.
Which is such a funny thing to imagine happening.
No longer Jewish, just because, you know. Yeah.
I did make this movie. I have been Jewish my entire life, but this movie convinced me that I should finally renounce my Jewishness. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What he actually said was, right now we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation. Yeah. And it was unbelievable. So. But that's your dose of pop culture that we try to sprinkle on into the show. And Oppenheimer won everything. I don't know why they can't divide it a little bit, like spread the love. I don't know why every single award has to go to the same movie.
Weren't people also upset that Barbie got snubbed and this was deemed a huge act of sexism or something like that?
Yeah. I guess so. I mean, if you've seen Barbie, you may understand that it wasn't sexism that got it deprived of the Academy Award. It would have been absurd if it had won an Academy Award. I think it won for something like set design or something, but if it had gotten Best Picture, that would have been an outrage. So I slept well knowing it didn't. So what do we got for Democrats Suck, Aaron?
For Democrats Suck, we're gonna get a glimpse of this showdown in Washington over TikTok, where the people in charge are not happy that young people are not turning into the reliable corporate propaganda networks to get their news, but they're using TikTok. So what is Congress doing? Well, the House just passed a bill to effectively ban TikTok. And here, with all her wisdom, is Nancy Pelosi explaining why this is a winning move.
This is not an attempt to ban TikTok. It's an attempt to make TikTok better. Tic-tac-toe, a winner.
She knows how to speak to kids. She gets the youth.
Yes.
Kids love tic-tac-toe.
Tic-tac-toe, yes. And of course, this is actually an attempt to ban TikTok. It would declare TikTok to be unlawful and force it to change ownership. That's a ban. That's basically a ban.
Which is effectively a ban.
Yeah. Now, to understand why the elites are melting down about TikTok, one reason is because on TikTok, apparently, you know, posts that that talk about the rights of Palestinians are really popular and have gotten a lot of circulation. And this is not good for the people in Washington who, of course, are overseeing and complicit in this genocide in Gaza. And a person who actually explained this very well is Jonathan Greenblatt. He is the head of something called the Anti-Defamation League, which in real life is just a, you know, Israel lobby group dedicated to defaming Palestinians and their supporters.
Right.
That's what it is. And
including Jewish Voice for Peace, for
anybody,
instance.
Anybody.
The Jewish organization, they consider a hate group.
Yeah, and it's also a shakedown racket. So, like, what they'll do is, unless you pay them a lot of money, you might find yourself accused of being an anti-Semite. And that's just what they do.
I didn't know that part. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Well, so here's Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, on MSNBC explaining why TikTok is such a threat.
We need to talk about TikTok. TikTok, if yes. you will, it is the yeah. is the 24/7 news channel of so many of our young people, and it's like Al Jazeera on steroids, amplifying and intensifying the anti-Semitism and the anti-Zion with no repercussion.
Well, it's interesting you played that clip, Aaron. I thought you were going to play the clip of him on leaked audio saying Israel has a TikTok problem.
Well, let's hear that too.
Impressed that he said something that he said on leaked audio on actual television. Like, if I were him, I would want to kind of dissociate myself from that.
Well, that's because they really have a TikTok right. problem, sure. as he makes sure to stress in that leaked tape.
So
that's the reason. That's one of the reasons is, you know, they can't control what kids are sharing and posting on TikTok. Right. And, you know, when people are actually left in the free market to make their own decision, they end up actually not being for a genocide and opposing it. Right. And that's a problem for people like Jonathan Greenblatt and Nancy Pelosi and everybody else in Congress.
He also, on that same leaked audio, said that we know certain things because we have analysts in these groups talking about justice for Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. So they do have spies. They have infiltrators.
They really have infiltrators.
They really have infiltrators.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so that's what they do. They resort to infiltration and censorship. And that's what they have to do, is because they actually cannot handle the truth getting out. They have to try to subvert it via outright censorship and infiltration and trying to mess with these groups. It's unbelievable what is promoted inside. I mean, Congress should be banning people like Jonathan Greenblatt and his group from infiltrating groups. I mean, that's what's actually a threat to young people, not letting people make up their own mind via their social media platforms like TikTok.
Exactly. Yep. Let's stick to TikTok for Republicans suck, please. And let's take a look at what Republican Ashley Hinson of Iowa had to say about TikTok. And now, to be fair, she's not as cool. She doesn't have the tic-tac-toe moves that Nancy has, but she's still impressive. Let's hear what she had to say.
The day after we introduced our bill, TikTok went into panic mode. They lied to their users, saying Congress was going to ban TikTok, using young kids as political pawns. TikTok's gross stunt proved our point. What if on election day, TikTok sent out an alert saying our elections were canceled? We must act now. Today, we're sending a message to the CCP that we are going to deflate the 140 million spy balloons that they have installed on American phones. We must act and pass this bill today. Thank you. I yield back.
Unbelievable. Sky balloons. What if they did that and called off the elections?
I mean, again, we've covered this. That was such a joke. The spy balloon thing, those were weather balloons that went off course.
Right.
Didn't collect any information, as Mark Milley later on admitted. But they're still making the spy balloon farce a thing.
Right.
And I guess that they're that desperate because they have to justify taking away the favorite app of the youth, you know? So they're trying to scare them with the spy balloon stuff.
Right.
Man, oh man. And again, on TikTok, there was probably better reporting about the spy balloon than there was on corporate TV.
Because
on corporate TV, remember, that was nonstop fear-mongering. The Chinese have invaded the spy balloons. We have to respond. This is an act of war. On TikTok, probably people were making fun of that, which is what it deserved because that was such a farce.
Right. They also, it's funny, it's like this TikTok problem is just young people not being propagandized as much as old people by places like AIPAC.
Exactly.
Young people see this stuff and they're just like, this isn't fair.
Yep.
Why are these Palestinians being treated like this?
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the decades of indoctrination.
Take away their app.
That's the only
answer,
solution.
For isn't that weird, we're going to turn to some political news, not from the Republican and Democratic primaries, where it's pretty much now been decided that Trump and Biden are going to square off. That's official. But there's also RFK Jr., who was once considered, you know, a serious outsider candidate, running first as a Democrat and then as a third party. But then came his insane, unhinged support for Israel, which was even more extreme than Joe Biden's.
Which is saying a lot.
Saying a lot. And so a lot of, you know, young people who were maybe been excited by his candidacy kind of dropped off because it's hard to get excited about a guy who's hanging around with Shmuley Boteach and spouting off every racist talking point there is to justify the Israeli occupation and mass murder of Palestinians. But RFK Jr. is still running, and there's going to be soon an announcement of his vice presidential nominee. And this, according to the rumor mill, are the top two candidates. Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers and former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura top RFK Jr.'s list of potential running mates. Wow. Kennedy's confirmed to ABC.
Wow.
So that's quite the slate. I wonder who it'll be. I will say, fun fact, if it becomes Jesse the Body Ventura, that would mean you have two World Wrestling Entertainment Hall of Famers in the presidential race, because Donald Trump is also, on top of being a former president, is also a member of the WWE Hall of Fame. And so would be Jesse. So is Jesse Ventura. So that'd be pretty amazing to have two members of the Wrestling Hall of Fame in the presidential race for 2024.
It'd be a real rumble.
It'd be a real rumble, a royal rumble indeed.
Yeah. Also, you know, Bobby Kennedy, he released a Twitter video or Instagram or TikTok or tic-tac-toe or maybe all of them doing push-ups shirtless. So maybe he's into, you know, sports, and he and Jesse could wrestle around, train together.
RFK Jr. is in fantastic shape.
Yes.
He's in great shape. He also had that video where he's working out in jeans. He's shirtless and he's in jeans.
Yeah, that's the one I'm referring to. Yeah.
Strange garb. But he's in great shape.
Yeah.
And it got people excited for him. Some people got excited for it. But again, then he opened his mouth and started talking about Israel. And man, oh man, he really killed that buzz, at least
really
for me.
Did.
You know, a lot of what he said about Ukraine, it was great. I really agreed with it. It was exciting. And he also supports Julian Assange, you know, so there's things about him to appreciate, but then the Israel stuff is just unhinged. And listen, I love Jesse the Body Ventura. I mean, he, as a wrestling personality, which I grew up watching, he was hilarious. He's in some fantastic films. He's in Predator. He's in Running Man. As a governor of Minnesota, he won as a genuine outsider.
Right.
Pretty amazing. He hosted a show on RT and was anti-war. He lost a show on MSNBC because he was against the Iraq war. So there's a lot there to admire in him. But unfortunately, RFK Jr. in Israel, man.
Yeah.
It's a
bad sign when you have photo ops with Rabbi Shmuley.
You should be running away
from him.
Exactly. You should stay as far away from Rabbi Shmuley as possible.
Yeah.
Unless he's trying to get up in your camera, as he did with that kid you interviewed who he harassed at a skating rink. Right?
Jamal. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was great. Absolutely unhinged. Yeah.
Well, speaking of unhinged Israel supporters.
Isn't That Terrible? We have a Twitter video from Lee Kern. Now, Lee Kern's claim to fame is being one of the many screenwriters on the Borat 2 film. He also goes to Israel a lot and hangs out with people like Noah Tishby and Michael Rapaport. And much like Michael Rapaport, he really has a lot of feels about Israel, its supporters or its opponents and critics. Let's take a look at this video that he released.
Hey, just a quick message to all the pussy Jewish Hollywood celebrities not speaking out. How's it going? How's it going? Is it getting better? Not speaking out. Are things getting better? Do you like it more now? Yeah, is the world nicer with you not speaking out? It's getting better, yeah? It's getting better, isn't it? Yeah, it's getting better, isn't it? Probably keep not speaking out because it's getting better. Just don't speak out. Carry on. Just keep doing what you're doing. Keep shtum. It's getting better, isn't it? It's getting really great, isn't it? Yeah, you keep not speaking out. It's good. It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Just keep not speaking out. It's getting better, isn't it?
Okay, so he and I disagree politically. Fair enough. I'd be honest if I thought there were anything comedic or artistically valuable. You know, you got to respect your opponents, right? When they're talented. That to me, though, is I don't even know what to say about that. I mean, except for isn't that terrible? But he's kind of like having a breakdown on camera.
Yeah. Does he think someone's going to be swayed by this video, that someone's going to speak out now because he keeps saying it's getting better. The same words over and over
better.
And over.
It's getting better. Yeah. It's totally bizarre and unhinged. You know, he also wrote a very stupid video that Michael Rapaport starred in. And Michael Rapaport, it's like scripted, it's filmed, it has professional actors, all that stuff. And it is just Michael Rapaport feeding two women wings covered in feces because they are bullshit wings provided by Hamas. It's such an unfunny joke. And this guy, not only did he write it, but he put his name on the credits.
Are these like, is this like actual shit that I'm eating?
Yes, that is actual shit you are eating. No, don't stop now. You've been eating that Hamas shit for so long.
I mean, again, we keep coming back to the theme where Zionism really ruins comedy. It just does. It can even, you know, Jews are a funny people. You know, there's a lot of great Jewish humor, but these people, everything they say is just so cringe. It's every video is worse than the next.
Yeah. So angry too. Yeah. Who, I mean, this is a great anti-Zionist propaganda because it just makes Zionists look insane.
It really does.
Unbelievable. Unhinged. And there's your four basic food groups. We are so excited to be speaking to Ali Abu Nima. He is the director of the great site Electronic Intifada, and he's also the author of One Country and the Battle for Justice in Palestine. And you can follow him on Twitter at Ali Abu Nima. That's Aliabunimah. Welcome back to the show, Ali Abu Nima. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you, Aaron.
So you've been really diligently following the mass rape allegations that have been made by the media and then by the UN, kind of. They've kind of made those allegations. There's a lot of confusion in the way that they're being reported on. So I wanted you to clarify what Pramila Patton's UN report said and kind of more generally, where we are in the investigation into what happened on October 7th in terms of sexual violence.
Well, the bottom line is we are now well into the sixth month of this genocide, which is partly justified on the basis of these allegations and other claims of atrocities that have turned out to be false. And to this day, not a single specific victim, living or dead, has been identified where anyone can say with certainty, yes, this is a victim. We keep hearing the refrain, believe Israeli women, and we believe Israeli women. To this date, there's not a single Israeli woman who has come forward to say that she was a victim or survivor of this kind of assault. And so there's no women to believe at this point. We're told that Israel has tens or hundreds of thousands of video clips taken, filmed on October 7th, and this includes footage from helmet cameras of Palestinian fighters, surveillance footage from security cameras around the various kibbutzes and so on, drone and helicopter cameras, cell phone video taken by ordinary people, and not a single one of them shows a sexual attack taking place, which is remarkable given that we're told, you know, the claim is not that there were, you know, a couple of sexual assaults on October 7th. The claim is that this was a systematic and deliberate campaign of sexual violence and rape as a weapon of war. And if that were true, the evidence would be everywhere. Instead, we're told repeatedly that no victims have been identified. There's no video, no forensic evidence, no photographic evidence. And that is the case, that remains the case, despite the UN report. What the UN report did was simply to compile allegations from the Israeli military, primarily, and so-called Israeli national institutions. We know that Pramila Patton, the special representative of the Secretary General on sexual violence, was accompanied, for example, this is from published pictures that the Israelis released. She was accompanied when she toured a kibbutz in the south by Yossi Landau, the man from Zaka, the Jewish extremist organization that is known to have fabricated multiple atrocity claims, including the fabricated story of a pregnant woman having her belly sliced open and the fetus stabbed. So even though the UN report is very vague on where it's getting its information from, we do know that that Pramila Patten met with a fabricator and liar like Yossi Landau, and we know that she received much of the information from the Israeli government.
And just to get a sense of what kind of character Yossi Landau is, here he is talking about his method.
Take care. When we go into a house and we're using our imagination, I said, the bodies is telling us the stories that happened to him.
So that's in some where we are. And I'll say that there are some positive aspects of the UN report, which we can talk about, which is it actually debunks some of the most common claims that have been made, including some of the claims that were published in the New York Times.
What were the key New York Times claims that were debunked? And what do you make of the Times continuing to stand by their story, even as it's been repeatedly discredited, the more we've learned about it? I mean, Ali, you and I were among the people who initially pushed back against the story and pointed out some of the major problems with it, just in the supposed witnesses that they relied on, how their own stories just didn't add up, along with a complete absence of any forensic evidence. And then we learned more about who the writers were of this story, which included a writer who liked posts calling for the genocide of Palestinians, who worked with a relative of hers, I believe, or someone she knew well, and who even told people that they were doing this in the service of Israeli Hasbara, aka propaganda.
Right. You're talking about Anat Schwartz, the never-before journalist who was assigned on this major story by the New York Times and brought along her partner's nephew, Adam Seller. And they were working under the overall leadership of Jeffrey Gettleman, the Pulitzer Prize winner. And that's supposed to impress us all and dissuade us from asking questions. But let's start, like you asked me, the allegations that were debunked by the UN report. So one of the central allegations in the New York Times article by Gettleman, Schwartz, and Seller that was published on December 28th was claimed to have happened in Kibbutz Be'eri. And this story had already circulated in multiple media accounts prior to the New York Times publishing it. And the basic story is that an Israeli army medic went into a bedroom in a house in Kibbutz Be'eri and found two teenage girls who had been murdered. All of these things are horrific to even talk about, whether they're true or false. So these two teenage girls were found together murdered and in a state of undress, and one of them had semen on her back. So a really graphic scene that was described, again, with no forensic evidence, no crime scene photos, no nothing that could confirm this account from an anonymous person whose identity was never revealed. I don't think we've ever seen an interview with them. And I think this person, when they spoke to the New York Times, it was described in the Gettleman article that the Israeli military allowed the person to speak to the New York Times on condition that their anonymity be maintained. So this is how dubious all the sourcing is. Now, that particular story had been debunked repeatedly. I think Mondo Weiss convincingly debunked it at the beginning of December. So we're talking about almost a month before the New York Times published it without any question. Mondo-wise, they had pointed out, having gone through the lists of victims that Israel had published of dead people, that no two girls found together. There were no victims in Kibbutz Be'eri that fit this description. And then subsequently, in recent weeks, The Intercept confirmed that this did not happen in Kibbutz Be'eri, that there were no incidents of sexual violence in Kibbutz Be'eri, and the kibbutz authorities were very clear about that. And the UN report says that the incident in Kibbutz Be'eri is unfounded. And yet, despite the fact that the UN report actually further undermines and debunks the reporting of the New York Times, the New York Times first trumpeted it as in their headline as saying that the UN had found evidence of sexual violence, as if to corroborate what they'd previously reporting. And the New York Times also falsely quoted the report. They claimed that the report used the phrase clear and convincing evidence. That phrase was never in the UN report. Subsequently, the New York Times, as they often do, surreptitiously changed the headline, fixed the quote without any acknowledgement or note.
A stealth edit.
Not very stealth, because nowadays we all notice it, but they tried. So that's just an example of how it debunks their fraudulent reporting.
And what is the term used by the UN report? Just to stress this, it's not evidence, it's information.
Yes.
Which basically means, which is an allegation, because they also stress that the source for their so-called information is the Israeli government.
Correct.
So basically all they're relaying in the report is what the Israeli government told them, or Israeli government furnished sources told them, which they're very clear is not evidence. It's just information, a.k.a. an allegation, a.k.a. a lie, according to all the available evidence that we've gone through.
There is this sort of terminology that we're familiar with from, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but you know, you read a lot of legal reports, or you watch trials, or you whatever it is, we all become familiar with some of this terminology. So there are terms like beyond a reasonable doubt that is common, and there are terms like clear and convincing evidence, and that's a lower standard that is used in the context, for example, in the United States of civil trials, as opposed to criminal trials, where you have the standard beyond a reasonable doubt. But a phrase that I had never heard before was clear and convincing information. What does that even mean? And that's the phrase that the UN report uses, clear and convincing information. Well, as you say, Aaron, that could mean anything. I mean, it seems to be a phrase that is designed to generate in the mind of the person reading it or hearing it that there is something substantial here. But at the same time, it avoids the word evidence, because evidence is something very specific, whereas information can be absolutely anything. And so that's just kind of the verbal trickery in the report. And I think that it's important for people to understand some of the arcane processes of the UN, which I won't get into in great detail, but just to understand who is Pramila Patten, the author of this report. She is the special representative of the Secretary General, which means she's a political appointee. She is not an independent human rights expert appointed by the Human Rights Council. You have this group of independent UN experts who are called special rapporteurs, people like Francesca Albanese, who a lot of people are familiar with. She's the special rapporteur on human rights in the occupied territory, and people may have seen her. I don't know if you've had her on the show.
We're trying.
Yeah. Well, so, but she's been on other shows, and she's very prolific on Twitter, and people can see from the kind of language she uses that she is independent. You know, you may agree with her or disagree with her on some points, but it's very clear that she's willing to say things that people in other positions won't say, because her mandate comes from the UN Human Rights Council. So that's one category of independent UN expert. The other category is you have commissions of inquiry, which are independent and which are, again, mandated by the UN Human Rights Council, for example. And we've seen those reports, those commissions of inquiry appointed after each of Israel's massacres in Gaza since 2008. And their reports will be very thorough and generally very credible. And the figures who are appointed to them are usually outside figures, which may include, for example, former senior judges from various countries or senior jurists. But a special representative of the Secretary General, like Pramila Patten, is a political appointee who is answerable only to the Secretary General, who is himself in a political role, as we've seen. So, because I've seen people say, oh, well, it's a UN report. How come you believe some UN reports and not others? And the answer to that is twofold. One, you have to see what is the mechanism by which this report is being produced. And here it's clearly a political mechanism designed for a political goal. And the other element is what's in the report. Not all UN reports are created equal. You actually have to read the report and look at the information in it. And when you do that, you find that this is simply another regurgitation of the same allegations they've been bringing up since October, and provides zero new evidence.
So I wanted to quote two parts of a press conference that Pramila Patten was at. And here's what she had to say about the widespreadness of alleged rape. I do not go into prevalence. I do not have numbers in the report because for me, one case is more than enough. It's not about, I didn't go on a bookkeeping exercise. The first letter that I received from the government of Israel talked about hundreds, if not thousands, of cases of brutal sexual violence perpetrated against men, women, and children. I have not found anything like that. So there she is acknowledging that not only was there not hundreds and thousands of cases, but she didn't even look at prevalence because one case is enough. So that debunks the claim that it was mass in nature and used as a weapon on a mass scale. And she also said at this press conference, given the multiple actors, it was Hamas, it was Palestinian Islamic Jihad, there were other armed groups, there were civilians, armed and unarmed. I did not go into attribution given the time and given the fact that I was not conducting an investigation. And what's interesting, again, is that you had CBS reporting, for instance, UN says reasonable grounds to believe Hamas carried out sexual attacks on October 7th. Associated Press and Time said, UN envoy says reasonable ground to believe Hamas committed sexual violence on October 7th. And really, if the media were responsible, it would say claims of mass rape by Hamas debunked, because she acknowledges that it wasn't mass. And also, to the extent that there were any crimes, it wasn't committed that we know of by Hamas, because there were so many people there. Again, this is about gathering information and engaging in, according to the mission, advocacy, which is very different from an investigation.
Correct. But all that is, you know, she's complicit in the spinning of this as being more than it is, you know, and presenting this as the, finally, we have the UN investigation that proves all this. Because all of those crucial caveats are sort of buried deep right in the report, including the conclusion, the really important conclusion that they couldn't find, that, you know, they say, I don't have the text in front of me, but they say pretty much straight up, we conducted open source investigations of thousands of images and videos. And the same with information that they had received from their sources, presumably the Israeli government, and they could identify no evidence in the photos and videos of sexual violence. They say they can't determine that there was any systematic sexual violence or its prevalence. So they say all these things, and also they say some of these incidents, as I mentioned, unfounded, that have been in fact, the most widely reported incident of these two girls in Kibbutz Be'eri, unfounded, according to the UN report. And yet all that is buried in the fine print, so to speak. And And Pramila Patton did the job she was supposed to do of going before the cameras and giving credence to all this stuff that her report cannot substantiate in any way. Right. And all the media went along with it. And this is what this whole exercise was for.
I mean, the correct or the responsible media headlines around this would be UN report debunks claim of mass rape used as a weapon.
Yeah. And also debunks key claim of of raped teenage girls. Right. You know, that it debunks that, and it debunks the claim of mass rape. But it's being spun as the exact opposite of what it is, which is why, you know, people like us will never have a spare moment, because they just keep coming at us with this. And you have to keep debunking the same things. There were no new story, you know, from what I read, I couldn't see any new allegations or incidents. It's the same ones that they've been, the same handful of sensational atrocity stories that have been repeated since October.
And if you read the stories about this that have come out in the U.S. media, Israeli media, they can't make up their mind whether there are even people who were subjected to sexual assault, allegedly, who are still alive or not. Sometimes they say everyone's dead, or they say there are some, but they don't want to talk to anybody. Right. They won't talk to police. They won't come forward. They won't cooperate. So even their narrative hasn't gotten its story straight. And I'm just curious, Ali, like, what do you make of how widely this was accepted? Back when this was first rolled out, I believe it was late November, early December, as global criticism of the Israeli genocide is massive. This was obviously done because they needed a distraction from what was actually going on in front of our eyes. So they rolled this out. And I think they knew that contesting or questioning a sexual assault allegation is very difficult. It's a very sensitive topic, obviously. And the few of us who did push back immediately, who pointed out how ridiculous these stories were, like this one purported Israeli witness, a man, said that he witnessed a beautiful woman with the face of an angel being gang raped by 8 to 10 people. And he also said that he saw a militant take a shovel and chop off someone's head with it, and the head rolled in front of him. I mean, these insane stories that just made no sense.
And those weren't corroborated by anyone else.
No, yeah, and there's no physical evidence for any of that. And those who pointed out how ridiculous all these stories were, you know, called rape apologists and all that. And, if someone had accused Israelis of this, even though there's so much evidence of Israeli barbarism, including sexual violence, I don't think these stories would have been believed. So what do you think was the basis for just how easily accepted these outlandish tales were?
Right. And I think it's important to remember that these stories emerged immediately. I went back and looked, and Zay Squirrel, one of our favorite Twitter accounts, who's done so much investigation of this, was pushing back on the mass rape claims on October 9th. On Twitter. So we're really talking about these stories coming out immediately. Now, at the beginning, you could say, well, if we wanted to be really generous and really, you could say, well, in the fog of war, so to speak, stories circulate, horror stories come out, and then, you know, later they're debunked or the truth is sorted out from what is not true. But that never happened here. You know, it's very clear that from the first moment, there were people like Yossi Landau and Zaka and Israeli soldiers on the ground, the ones who also spread the stories of, the beheaded babies and all of these fake stories, were pushing these stories from the beginning. And then it became and I think the mass rape stories were all part of that morass of propaganda. And later, we saw sort of mid to late October, we started to see these stories being pushed in an organized manner by the Israeli state and lobby groups outside the country in a much more organized fashion. And I think that was a response to the fact that by that point, people were just utterly horrified by what Israel was doing in Gaza. And all that initial wave of sympathy with Israel of October 7th was fading. And this, why, so the question is, why did people so readily believe this narrative? I think there's a number of factors. One is, I think a primary factor is just sheer racism, that people, you know, in the so-called liberal West are ready to believe that Arab men, Muslim men are capable and eager to do this kind of thing. They've been so demonized for so long. And this is a very old impulse in Western and colonial societies, where allegations of rape and sexual predation have often been used against colonized and enslaved men. This was a staple of Jim Crow in the United States. Allegations of rape, or simply looking or addressing a white woman a wrong, you know, in a way that was considered unacceptable, was the pretext for lynching. This is central. You look at the Jim Crow Museum. They have a great website, a lot of educational resources. They talk about how the rape accusation, the idea of the black brute, threatening the pristine white women, was a staple in racist, really a central idea in the system of racial oppression in the United States.
And lynching.
And lynching, yeah. But not just certainly lynching, but also the general, it was considered a general justification for the need to control. You know, it was a justification for why we need to control these so-called brutes. So there's that. And I think it also, we know going back, for example, in 2010, this Israeli think tank, the Re'ut Institute, published this big report that was accepted by the Israeli government and the Israel lobby groups, warning that Israel is losing the progressive West. It's losing progressive and liberal opinion. So we need to double down on strategies like pinkwashing and greenwashing, portraying Israel as a bastion of women's rights, gay rights, environmentalism, and so on, amid, you know, a villa in the jungle, to quote Ehud Barak, a former Israeli prime minister. And so I think this narrative fits in very much with that, because it taps also into not just the older, crude racist ideas about brown men, Muslim men, black men, but also it taps into this contemporary Me Too sensibility and believe women. So, you know, if you're questioning these allegations, even though there are no actual women to believe in this case, then you are a horrible person who supports rape, and you're an atrocity denier. And all these things were deployed to try to convince people on the one hand, and to dissuade them from questioning it on the other.
We also know from, as the Gray Zone reported, we know that Frank Luntz did a focus group and asked participants to state which alleged act by Hamas they found bothered them the most. And they were given a kind of a list of various allegations. And the one that most people were most bothered by was the claim of raping civilians. So it's a very useful propaganda.
Yes, and it's been used repeatedly. So, for example, this very same Pramila Patton, who wrote this UN report, had previously disseminated totally baseless claims, and she admitted she had no evidence for them, that Russian soldiers had been given Viagra and told to go out and rape Ukrainian women. And prior to that, the Hillary Clinton State Department used the same false claims that Viagra had been given to Libyan soldiers. This was in 2011, and told to go out and use rape as a weapon of war. And this lie was told in the Security Council by Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the UN at the time. And in order to justify and build support for Barack Obama's destruction of Libya. And again, subsequently, U.S. intelligence agencies and Sharif Bassiouni, the late Sharif Bassiouni, a senior UN investigator came out later and said there's no evidence for this. But by that point, the propaganda had served its purposes. So we have now this common line and this common refrain when you question the evidence or say there's no evidence. People say, oh, but, you know, rape is endemic in war. Where there's war, there's rape. So it must have happened. Even if the evidence isn't there, it must have happened. Well, that may or may not be the case. I haven't looked closely enough at enough evidence to say. I can believe that rape and sexual violence is often there in wars, but so is atrocity propaganda and lies. And so just saying that, well, you know, rape is a feature of war, doesn't get you off the hook from actually providing evidence or examining the evidence that is claimed to be there.
It's also so ironic because you had Hillary Clinton laundering that lie about Gaddafi. And then the way Gaddafi was killed actually was through an act of sexual violence. And yeah, no one talks about that. No one condemned that. No one brought that up. And these people are supposed to be concerned with sexual violence.
Right. And including, they say, against Israeli men. They claim that Israeli men were victims, although just like with Israeli women, there are no Israeli men to believe on this. But yeah, and as we know, Hillary Clinton was utterly delighted with the murder of Gaddafi and, you know, cackled about it on camera. So it clearly did not bother her. And as you've also pointed out, there are these very credible reports of systematic sexual violence against Palestinian women and children, violence and humiliation, and men, some of which the Israelis have published themselves. You know, these images of men and sometimes boys being stripped naked and humiliated. There are testimonies from Palestinian women saying what they personally experienced. This is unlike in the case of Israel's allegations, where no Israeli woman has come forward and said, this happened to me. And yet none of this is taken seriously. None of it is given the prominence. And this goes back not just to the current genocide, but it's gone back years. We've seen report after report from human rights organizations about how routine it is as a tactic for Israeli interrogators, Shin Bet interrogators, to threaten sexual violence against sometimes minors, children, or to threaten sexual violence against their family members if whoever they're interrogating doesn't cooperate with them. And those threats of sexual violence are themselves a form of sexual violence. It's not, you know, it's on a continuum. And there have been reported cases of rape of Palestinian women. There was one case, I wrote about this a couple of years ago when I was working on and helping with an affidavit in a human rights case of a Palestinian woman where that allegation was very well documented. She was in custody and there were a large number of people who witnessed what happened or participated in it and nobody was indicted. So, you know, again, it goes to show that it's just sadly another measure of how little Palestinian lives are worth in the current world order.
And you also have that story that Josh Paul, who resigned from the State Department, revealed, where a charity presented to the State Department an allegation that a minor, a boy, had been raped in custody, in IDF custody. And the State Department deemed that was credible, and they took it to the government of Israel, and Israel's response was to shut down the charity, the NGO, which had brought that case forward.
That's right, yeah. That there is that case, too. And as I say, these reports and documentation of this goes back decades, not just to October 7th.
And you never hear or see headlines about this.
And if you say it, you're accused of. I think, you know, Rashida Tlaib, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, made a statement in Congress a couple of weeks ago where sadly she gave credence to these baseless allegations of mass rape by Israel. She was speaking in a debate on a resolution condemning the so-called mass rapes by Hamas. And her approach to it was, yes, we should condemn this, but what about what Israel has done? What about the sexual violence against Palestinians? Of course, I don't agree with that position. She should have pushed back against the false allegations. But she was right about, you know, to highlight the sexual violence that Palestinians experience. And the response from many of her colleagues, including Democrats, is this is a blood libel. You know, if you even bring up these allegations, it's a blood libel.
Right. Because Jews don't rape, but Palestinians do.
Elliot, let me ask you to talk about another aspect of all this is that, you know, one reason why these allegations are so easily disseminated is that you have such an integration of, you know, U.S. and Israeli government officials inside our media and also inside our academic institutions. So, for example, at Columbia University, they held this recent conference about the weaponization of sexual violence in war. It was hosted by Hillary Clinton, who now teaches at Columbia. The star guest, or one of them, was Jeffrey Gettleman, the lead author of the New York Times piece. Also featured was Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook executive who's doing a documentary making these allegations about Hamas sexual violence on October 7th. And the school at Columbia where all this was held, SIPA, is headed by someone named Karen Yarhi Milo, who turns out to be an Israeli intelligence, former Israeli intelligence officer, grew up in Israel. And I also learned recently that Zaka, this so-called Israeli rescue group that was that provided key purported witnesses for the New York Times rape story and similar allegations, that when it comes to Zaka, and has been caught lying multiple times about multiple atrocity propaganda claims, that a board member of Zaka was none other than Stuart Seldowitz, the former Obama administration official who was involved in so-called peace negotiations, who was recently arrested for a hate crime for harassing Muslim halal cart vendors. So I'm just wondering, you know, your comments on just how deeply embedded the Israeli and U.S. governments are even in our academic institutions and how that leads to the dissemination of their propaganda.
Yeah, that event at Columbia, and we talked about that at some length on the Electronic Intifada live stream, and we showed some of the video of students protesting. I think for me it was a perfect encapsulation of that embeddedness, let's say. I mean, you had, as you pointed out, the dean of SIPA, the School of International Public Affairs, who's a former Israeli intelligence officer. You have the star guest, who is Hillary Clinton, you know, a war criminal of global proportions who needs no introduction. Then you have Sheryl Sandberg, who represents Silicon Valley complicity with all this and the cozy relationship between government and Silicon Valley. And then you have Jeffrey Gettleman, who represents the corrupt mouthpiece media that purports to be this fierce independent watchdog, but is just laundering government allegations and propaganda. And then you have the rest of us who are just shut out and shouting from the sidelines, who are represented by the students. And so that event by itself encapsulated the situation we live in. Why do these allegations spread so easily? Because there are no negative consequences for it. And in fact, it's meant to. The New York Times is doing its job by spreading these allegations. So to an earlier question, why is the New York Times defending this reporting after it's been debunked? Because that's their job. That's what they do. They launder allegations from the, they launder, should we call it information, from the government through anonymous sources and so on, as they've done repeatedly, most notoriously with the weapons of mass destruction lies that were the pretext for the Iraq war, but countless times. And for individuals, careerist individuals who have no qualms or principles, or who are completely, you know, brainwashed into this and think they're doing good work, there's no negative consequences, and all of this is rewarded. It's all, you get rewarded for it. Nobody gets rewarded for blowing the whistle on this stuff. On the contrary, what we've seen, because the Jeffrey Gettleman article laundering all these fake mass rape allegations. As we know now, the Intercept revealed that an episode of The Daily, the New York Times podcast, had to be scrapped because the New York Times' own internal fact checkers could not be convinced of the reliability of the Gettleman story. So they pulled the episode. And so this generated intense dissent and unease within the New York Times from those people naive enough to believe that they're hired there to be actual journalists who tell the truth. And what did the New York Times do in response to that? They are carrying out a witch hunt against Arab and Muslim employees to find out who leaked this information about the internal dissent. So that's what the New York Times is, that they're defending their integrity as a government mouthpiece when they defend this fake reporting.
And Jeffrey Gettleman actually said at this Columbia conference, during his presentation, he said, "I don't want to even use the word evidence because evidence is almost like the legal term that suggests you're trying to prove an allegation or prove a case in court."
We interviewed almost 200 people over the course of 2 months. And what we found, I don't want to even use the word evidence because evidence is almost like a legal term that suggests you're trying to prove an allegation or prove a case in court. That's not my role. We all have our roles, and my role is to document, is to present information, is to give people a voice. And we found information along the entire chain of violence, so of sexual violence.
So what was his article doing?
See, that, thanks for bringing that up, Katie, because he made that statement at the Columbia event several weeks before, or more than a month before, the UN report came out, using this curious term that we just talked about, clear and convincing information. So Gettleman himself had made this distinction a few weeks earlier, where he said, "Oh, I'm not providing evidence, I'm just providing information." So he was making a distinction which acknowledges that information is something less than evidence. And of course, he was doing that to cover himself, right, because by this point, so much of his story had been debunked. But he was also backing off from his story by doing so, because he wasn't willing to stand by it and say there is evidence for all these things he claimed had happened. And I do wonder, I'm curious to know what you both think, whether this is a coincidence, right, that he had made that distinction between information and evidence, and the UN report doing it a month later. Is that just a coincidence? I genuinely don't know. Or is this like a coordinated talking point? Okay, let's not use evidence, let's use information. It still sounds serious, but you can't really hang anything on it.
Right, it lowers the bar, right?
Yeah. But was that just a coincidence? It's too...
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She could have heard him say it, or it could have been behind closed doors decision. Yeah.
Let me ask you about one more funny thing about Gettleman that I noticed. So after he publishes that initial story, we then push back on it. The Gray Zone, Electronic Intifada, Mondo Weiss all publish articles and videos just pointing out all the flaws in his story. Then Gettleman comes out with this follow-up article, which is basically him just reasserting his initial claims while offering an elaborate attempt to justify them against unnamed critics, which is very bizarre. You don't see that it's talking to the news media where somebody comes at a criticism, they publish this lengthy rebuttal, but they don't really offer much new. And of course, he doesn't name his critics. He doesn't
Wait, Aaron, you weren't convinced about the heads they suddenly found?
Well, that's what I was going to bring up. So Gettleman publishes this weird article in the New York Times where he's responding to unnamed critics. He doesn't name us. He doesn't cite us. I think for obvious
or
reasons.
Link. They never do.
They don't like, but or they don't want people to actually go and see what people are saying about his article and weigh the two, like compare the two, where I think people can make up their own minds and see who has a convincing case as to who's being factual or not. But the one thing he does do is, you know, like we pointed out that like one, this key witness named Sapir,
yeah,
claimed to have seen three decapitated women. And we pointed out, like, where are the heads for these decapitated women?
And where are the decapitated bodies? Where's all the blood? Where's the crime scene? This happened inside Israel, you know, in an area that Israel, you know, relatively quickly secured and had control over after October 7th. So there'd be no question that you would find the heads, you'd find the bodies, you'd find the massive, horrifying bloodbath on the ground. You'd find all sorts of physical evidence that could be photographed, could be collected. And there was none. The story that Sapir told, the so-called witness called Sapir, was that she saw multiple women being gang raped and murdered, and she saw the Hamas fighters, you know, she also saw them, and again, I apologize for the graphic language and descriptions, but this is what they're claiming, so we have to talk about it, that they sliced off the breast of one of the women and they were tossing it around like a ball, and then they were dancing around, prancing around with seven heads. And the first question you ask when you hear this is, well, where are the heads? Where are the bodies?
So Gettleman now all of a sudden out of nowhere tries to give us an answer after his article has come under scrutiny. He did not have this in his first article. But in his second article, after he comes under scrutiny, all of a sudden, guess what? The heads have been found. And this is what the New York Times, this is what Gettleman says. He mentions this in passing. Three severed heads were found farther away near the bodies of assailants in military fatigues, Israeli officials said, without providing more detail. So all of a sudden, months later, and after Gettleman has already done his supposed months-long investigation, all of a sudden, Gettleman is claiming that Israeli officials have told him that they magically have found three severed heads, which he mentioned sort of in passing. It's like, and we've seen this claim nowhere else. Like, nowhere in Israeli media have they claimed, oh, by the way, October 7th, three severed heads have been found. Like, this should be front page news. Gettleman throws that in there in passing.
And it's not in the UN report either, because Miller Patton went, you would assume that the Israelis would have been eager to show her and her team the evidence of these severed heads.
Exactly.
It's astonishing.
It's such a tell that Gettleman and his sources are lying through their teeth, and they're so desperate that they think they can get away with just all of a sudden casually mentioning that, oh yeah, by the way, three severed heads have been found. And then we're supposed to just not, we're supposed to just nod our heads and accept that. And he even says the Israeli officials couldn't provide any more detail. Yes, of course they couldn't, because you're all lying.
Yeah, and also with that same story of Sapir, which, you know, again, wasn't a new story by the time he published it in his big story on December 28th. It had already been circulating for weeks and months. And so in the early iterations, the woman, Sapir, who is named, given the name Sapir in the New York Times article, I don't think she had spoken herself to media, but what had happened was that at a press conference, I think this was in mid-October or early November, the Israeli police had played a video of her speaking with her identity blurred at a press conference. That's how her allegations sort of were disseminated widely. And at that time, Israeli media were reporting a second eyewitness or a second person who was with her at that scene, hiding with her in this ditch when she supposedly saw this. And that eyewitness, the only other eyewitness said to be there, had told Israeli media back when this story was first coming out that he didn't see any of this. That Sapir had told him about it, but he didn't see it. And then in the Gettleman piece, this second eyewitness is presented as having seen it himself. And although he doesn't talk about the seven heads, he just says he saw rape going on. So again, you know, you can see how it's like the fabrications became more extreme as time went on. We have a guy who's saying to the media, I didn't see this. She told me about it. She said she saw this, but I didn't see it. And then in the New York Times, he's reported as, yeah, I saw this myself.
And what's happening while all this is unfolding? So as we're even spending our time over the last month debunking all this, what's actually happening in real life is the most savage barbarism imaginable, with Israel, you know, massacring tens of thousands of people in the most sadistic, and then using starvation as a weapon. That's the actual sadism going on. But yet our propaganda system is so powerful and people are so obedient that they force the conversation onto a lie, that the, which then we then have to spend our time debunking rather than talking about what's actually the actual barbarism and cruelty and violence and genocide going on.
It's a dilemma because, you know, we all the time we spend on this is time we're not spending on highlighting the horrors of what's happening. But I still think that's it's important and inevitable work, because this propaganda is a weapon to kill Palestinians. It's intended. It's designed to kill Palestinians. So I think that debunking it, showing the truth, showing where the lies are, is an incredibly important way we have of fighting back. And it's a division of labor. Yeah, there are we can't only do this. We have to be doing the reporting on everything that's happening in Gaza and elevating the voices of people in and from Gaza. But we still have to do this. We have no choice but to confront and dismantle this propaganda.
Yeah, we have to do both, because, as you said, this really is propaganda that justifies the genocide. So, I mean, and people like you obviously do both, Ali, because you spend a lot of time not just debunking lies, but you actually then report on what the truth is and the, you know, genocide against Palestinians, because we can't just bury our heads in the sand because we think it shouldn't be focused on.
Right. And you can't let them get away with these narratives, right? Because these are racist, genocidal narratives that are designed to, like all atrocity propaganda, you know, you can go to the website of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and read about how atrocity propaganda was used to mobilize hatred against Jews, or at the very least, to make people indifferent to their persecution and extermination. And I think that that's the goal of this atrocity propaganda, at least to make people think, well, yeah, maybe what Israel is doing is not so great, but the people they're doing it to are animals, and so I'm not going to get too bothered by it. That's the goal of this.
I've heard, I mean, I've had people who are older say to me, well, Katie, you don't understand. These people, they do things like behead babies. I actually had someone say to me, there's violence, and then there's violence. These people are doing stuff like rape. Like it really is used to justify a kind of liberal Zionism, where we would love to not have to kill these people and genocide them, but they're such savages and beasts that we have to do that.
It's as if, I think we have to acknowledge how effective this propaganda can be, because I personally can think of a couple of people who we had been debunking and questioning the mass rapes propaganda for weeks or longer when the Jeffrey Gettleman article appeared at the end of December. And when that article appeared, I had people say to me, okay, now you have to take this seriously. You can't just dismiss it all as propaganda. And these are people who know very well what Israel does, what it's capable of, how much it lies. That made it even more important to push back on and debunk, when you could see how it was even, you know, even people who should and do know better fell prey to this propaganda. Yeah. That's how effective it is.
I mean, I'll just say, like, one person who ended up helping to debunk the Hamas sexual violence story initially peddled it. And that just, it speaks to how powerful our propaganda system is and how challenging it is for some people to think critically all the time when there are, you know, disincentives and consequences for pushing back. It works very effectively. Let's switch gears a little bit, Ali. Let me ask you to talk about the journalists in Gaza that you're working with at Electronic Intifada, to chronicle what it's like on the ground, the voices you've been featuring and the challenges they face.
Yeah, this is the thing that makes me most proud of our work at the Electronic Intifada, which is that our colleagues there have continued to report without a break. They are doing so under just indescribably difficult circumstances, which they try to describe. I mean, a lot of the reporting, because we don't want people going out and, you know, traveling great distances from where their family is or where they're sheltering. But, you know, to report, you don't have to, because everyone is going through such utter horror. I don't think there is practically anyone who has not been displaced and displaced multiple times. There is no one who hasn't lost multiple members of their extended family and their close family. And we've seen just from, you know, we typically work with around two dozen regular contributors and writers in Gaza. And four of our contributors have been killed since this genocide began. And they include Rifat al-Ar'ir, who many people know, Ra'id Qaddoura, Muhammad Hammo, and Huda al-Susi. They are all four contributors to the Electronic Intifada who have been killed. Ahmed Aburtema, the Israelis tried to assassinate him with an attack on his house in late October. They killed his 13-year-old son. They injured him. They injured two of his children. And they killed several members of his extended family. So it's just, you know, they are, people do not know from hour to hour if they will live or die. And at the beginning, people feared the bombing. They still fear the bombing, of course. But we had another writer of ours who's in the north who says, now people say, it's very common to hear people say, we'd prefer to die from bombing than from starvation, because the starvation is so awful, so painful, so horrifying. What's worse than the starvation for yourself is watching your elderly parents, your young children, people who are more vulnerable, whether because they have chronic sickness, suffering from starvation and dehydration. There's people, so many people in Gaza who have, just like everywhere else, chronic illnesses that can be relatively easily controlled with medications, whether it's type 2 diabetes or hypertension or various other serious conditions that we take it for granted that you can live with them with proper treatment.
Dialysis.
Dialysis. I'm getting to dialysis and cancer, but I'm just talking about the common condition where, you know, you take a daily pill and then, you know, for the most part, you're okay. Well, people have run out, you know, their parents, their grandparents have run out of the medication for their heart ailments, for hypertension, for hyperthyroidism, for whatever it is. All that's gone. So these conditions then start to become very serious and life-threatening, especially when you add in the conditions that people are living in. Newborn babies, there's something like, you know, a couple of hundred babies being born every day to women who are starved and malnourished, who have no prenatal care, no postnatal care, who cannot produce breast milk because they themselves are malnourished and dehydrated, and they don't have formula. And if they do have formula, they don't have clean water to prepare it. So newborn babies are being given inappropriate nutrition, and they are also becoming very sick and starting to die very quickly after they're born. You have people with more serious conditions who require, for example, as you mentioned, kidney dialysis, where that is now almost unavailable for most people. And you have people who are living with cancer. There's something like 10,000 cancer patients in Gaza who don't have treatment now, who don't have access to treatment. Everyone is living in this situation. But what amazes me is we ask people all the time, you know, it's hard to say, how are you doing? Because, or I hope you're well, because nobody is well. But everyone says, alhamdulillah, thank God, we're okay, we're still safe. We're, you know, assuming they can say that. But people have suffered terrible losses. And the writers, the Electronic Intifada, you can read their stories about the personal losses that they're experiencing, but also the losses to their communities, to their everything. The you know, one of our young writers, Abu Bakr Abid, we had him on our live stream a couple of weeks ago, which was amazing because it's now so rare to be able to get a live connection to Gaza, but we were able to that day. And one of the questions we asked him was, what are you looking forward to when this is over? You try to, you know, people want to have hope even in the worst situation. And he said, I want to continue my education. I want to finish my education. He's in university, but my university has been destroyed. And all the universities have been destroyed. And that's been systematic. The systematic destruction of the universities, the murder of the intelligentsia, the murder of journalists, targeted murder of journalists. And so maybe it's not the most urgent thing to think about now, but for the long term of Gaza, you know, the brain drain, the destruction of education, of institutions, of civil life, the fact that anyone who can, you know, you see so many people now trying to leave as a matter of survival, who can blame them? But this is also what Israel wants. And so it's just the scale of it is something that is just impossible to absorb, impossible to absorb. I don't know. I think you just have to sort of day to day, you keep doing the work. And if you stop to think about it too hard, it just becomes too demoralizing. So we just go on. And you hear that from medical professionals. They say, you know, people ask them, how do you cope with so much suffering? They say, you just have to kind of compartmentalize it and go on to the next patient, the next patient, to the next patient. And I don't compare what we do to that kind of direct life-saving work, but I think there's an element of that in how you have to approach the work, because I don't want to sit here and complain about what we go through and what our emotions are, because it's never going to pale. It's going to pale next to what people are living in Gaza. So the only thing I can say is I just need to be able to get up each day and do this. And if I can, that's the service I need to be able to do for people in Gaza. And that's, I think, how we approach it. Is I don't want to be less resilient than the people we work with there.
Ali, final question, and then we'll wrap. I want to get your response to Chuck Schumer. He just gave a speech on the Senate floor, basically casting himself now as a critic of Netanyahu and calling Netanyahu an obstacle to peace, basically personalizing this conflict in Netanyahu and basically calling on Israel to have new elections, and also presenting himself as being now critical of Israel's actions after Schumer, along with pretty much every other Democrat, with few exceptions, has given Israel unfettered support. So this is some of what Schumer said.
The fourth major obstacle to peace is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. As a lifelong supporter of Israel, it has become clear to me the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past. 5 months into this conflict, it is clear that Israelis need to take stock of the situation and ask, must we change course? At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel.
So, Ali, your response to that, this comes after Democrats got a big message from the voters of Minnesota and Michigan, with so many voting uncommitted in protest of Joe Biden's support for the Israeli genocide. And now Chuck Schumer is coming out as the leader of the Senate Democrats and saying, you know, yeah, he's a critic of Israel and he wants new elections to get rid of Netanyahu.
The problem is not Netanyahu. The problem is Israel and Zionism. And so this talking point, by the way, it's not new. It's been acceptable in Democratic Party circles for a couple of years to focus on the Netanyahu government. The Netanyahu government is bad. Bernie Sanders has done that a lot. And it's scapegoating Netanyahu. I mean, I'm certainly not defending Netanyahu, but the idea that if you remove Netanyahu, something better will emerge. Well, that was tested, wasn't it, with the Naftali Bennett government, another extreme fanatic. And the government of Israel at that time continued all of its brutal savagery and barbarism against the Palestinian people, including the ongoing theft of their land, but they just knew how to speak a slightly better language. And this effort by the U.S. administration to try to oust Netanyahu, you know, they're trying to do a regime change in Israel, basically. They invited Benny Gantz, the head of the alleged opposition, to Washington without the approval of Netanyahu, who is, after all, still the prime minister, in an effort to sort of groom him and anoint him as an alternative leader. And Gantz came to Washington and he disappointed his host by saying, I'd basically be doing the same things Netanyahu is doing. And that's true. I mean, the idea that Netanyahu is stifling the Israeli people, if anything, he's stifling extreme and Nazi impulses than are already there, because any Israeli prime minister has to, you know, they're always, how do I want to put it? Like, if there were an Israeli election, I mean, what does Chuck Schumer think will happen? That the Labour Party is going to get a majority and, you know, the Yitzhak Rabin will rise from the dead and there'll be a new Oslo peace process. I mean, if anything, it's going to be more of, what's his name, Ben-Gvir, Itamar Ben-Gvir, right, and Bezalel Smotrich and so on. And if anything, I think there's going to be a backlash at this kind of ham-fisted, is it anti-Semitic if I use the term ham-fisted?
I don't think so.
I need to know. Cause,
it's kosher. It's kosher. I mean, ham isn't, but I think you're using it as kosher. Yeah.
Okay, because Joe Biden did say that he had to have a come to Jesus talk?
I said that was anti-Semitic, yeah.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that, like, ham-fisted doesn't cross any red lines here. So, I think if anything, these attempts to overthrow Netanyahu, which is clearly what they are, by the Democratic, the genocide Democrats, as Max dubbed them in a recent speech, is only going to consolidate support around the far-right coalition.
Yeah, and then they get to take credit, right? Like Schumer gets to take credit for trying to push them in the right direction, in the correct direction.
How did he vote on the recent...
Of course, right.
Yeah.
It's interesting that Benny Gantz also is someone who cut a campaign ad bragging about sending parts of Gaza back to the Stone Age.
In 2014, when he was the chief of staff of the Israeli army, and he commanded that massacre, which was the worst we'd seen up to that point. And then in a few years later, when he had taken off his uniform and he was running for office at the head of his party, he did brag that I sent Gaza back to the Stone Age. And he's been doing that. He hasn't dissented in any way from what Israel is doing now. And he would continue it. I think we have to believe him. Believe Israeli men when they say that they would continue with the genocide in Gaza.
Ali Abanima of the Electronic Intifada, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both.
Well, thank you to Ali Abanima for joining us. That was insightful, as always. And again, the Electronic Intifada can be found at electronicintifada.net. It's a vital website for following what's happening in Palestine.
And you can find it on Twitter, Intifada, just the word Intifada.
And you can find us at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there to support the show and get bonus content. And thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.